Miki blinked, not having expected her to address him, and turned. "Beg pardon, Mrs. Morisato?" "Please, Miki, we're not in class. You can call me Belle if you like. Or Aunt Belle, if you want to be like most of Corwin's friends," she added with a puckish smile. "At any rate, what I'm getting at is this. You've been taught to play the guitar, and you've become quite good at it, but has anyone ever actually taught you how to play rhythm guitar in a band?" Miki shook his head. "No, Amanda doesn't have time to do that, and she's the only rhythm guitarist I know." Belle Dandy smiled. "Well, there you go, then. How can you expect to become a truly good rhythm guitarist without a mentor?" "I see your point, Mrs. Aunt Belle," said Miki. "But where am I going to find one? As I said, Amanda doesn't have time." "Amanda isn't the only rhythm guitarist in the system," said Belle. She pointed an admonishing finger at the mixer board and told it sternly, "Now you stay just like that, all right?" Standing next to the board, Lesser Mazinger folded his arms and nodded, as if to indicate that it had damned well better. Then she stood up, brushed down her skirt, and climbed up onto the riser next to Miki. "You're a rhythm guitarist?" he asked her, disbelief plain in his voice. Belle grinned at him, her eyes twinkling. "Back in our college days, my husband, my sisters, and I had a band. We still play sometimes, just for old time's sake. I bet I haven't lost the touch." She smiled at Kate. "Would you mind if I joined you, Caitlin?" Kate smiled back. Please, she said, "if it gives Miki some confidence." Belle nodded and, still smiling, folded her hands over her chest, eyes closed. "Come to me," she murmured, in that same language which Corwin Ravenhair sometimes used. "Double Z!" The thin, diamond-shaped mark on her forehead glowed, and suddenly, with a rush of air and an involuntary "Whoa!" from Moose, she was surrounded by a swirling vortex of white mist that obscured her completely from view. When she reappeared again, she was dressed completely differently, and in a manner that made Miki blink at her in utter astonishment. It wasn't all that different from the sort of things Amanda used to wear on stage. Black leather pants that looked like they were for motorcycle racing, an unfastened jacket to match, with NITMCC emblazoned in white letters down the arms, and a t-shirt with the Nokomi Institute of Technology seal. Her hair was out of its braid and in a thick sheaf, sprigs of it flying free all around her face. Slung over her shoulder was a scarlet Fender Stratocaster guitar, similar to Caitlin's black one, but right-handed.
"I think I'll say that again," said Moose dryly. "Whoa!"
Belle smiled. "It's been a while since I wore these clothes," she said. "I think I still remember, though." She hooked up, tuned up, and conferred briefly with Caitlin. Kate could be heard to murmur,
Are you sure?
But Belle seemed to convince her, because with a smile, the band leader went and got her own guitar as well. Then the band gathered themselves up, and, following Belle's cue, Dorothy launched them into another song. It didn't quite come off with the razor-sharp precision they'd played it with in Toronto. But their version of I Think I Like It was good. Damn good. Belle seized the rhythm line with both hands, counterpointing Kate and Azalin's competing leads and at the same time staying in lockstep with Dorothy and Moose, turning her scarlet strat into the glue that held the whole band together. Jury, who had been watching this byplay with some interest, blinked in amazement. She never would have guessed that Aunt Belle was a hard rock fan. Utina, who had spent a decent part of the summer under Belle's roof, grinned and went back to her homework. She'd heard the goddess singing I Want to Be Sedated, soft and sweet under her breath, many a time while helping her in the kitchen this past summer. When they finished playing, Belle regarded her guitar with some satisfaction and said, Yes. Was that useful, Mickey?
Mickey blinked. Very. Wow, I'm not sure I could ever play like that.
Belle gave him another of her bright, gentle smiles and said, Of course you can. It'll just take a bit of time and effort, that's all.
She turned to Kate. If you're open to it, Caitlin, I can take Amanda's place for now. I'll be here at the school, in Mr. Kesselring's place, for at least the rest of this calendar year, and I can have Mickey ready to take over from me by Christmas if he applies himself. In the meantime, he can teach someone else to take over for him on the soundboard.
That's fine with me, if Mickey doesn't mind being ousted, said Kate with a grin.
Mickey shook his head vigorously. Absolutely not. I'm at your feet, Mrs. Belle.
Kate gave Belle an indulgent smile and told her confidentially,
You'll break him of it eventually. He hardly ever calls me Miss Caitlin anymore.
So we're back on for a gig over break? Said Moose laconically.
If we can find one without Devlin, said Kate, a trifle glumly.
Well, that's a relief, said Moose, 'cause I got us one. We'll have to truck a little ways to do it. It's at a club on New Hokkaido, but a little bird tells me the place is nice and they get good crowds. We're the main act for Saturday night, November 5th.
Kate tried to look outraged and failed because of her grin.
Nice of you to warn us, she said.
Moose shrugged glacially.
I just did.
I think, said Dorothy calmly, we have a lot of work to do.
Kate nodded.
So let's get to it. Ready on the board, Mr. Kaworo?
Mickey looked up from the knobs and sliders, grinned, and said,
Ready.
Thursday, October 20th, 2405. The interior lights of CFA No Bull shone brightly from the bridge viewports, casting beams into early hour October morning fog. Inside, just below the plates of the cargo deck, Mac McKenzie tinkered with a small motor by the light of a hanging shop lamp. His pilot's headset rang not with the buzz of any ATC channel, but with the recordings of the previous day's lectures, turned up loud enough to penetrate the sleep deprivation fog closing in thicker around Mac than the real fog outside. Mac had not yet achieved the ultimate stage of sleep deprivation, the point where you begin hearing messages from the banana god, but he was getting there fast. The only regular sleep he got was Friday and Saturday nights, and that only because of Federation regulations, requiring that pilots get a minimum of 6 hours sleep before any 12-hour shift of flying. This particular week, the day was Thursday, or would be when the sun rose, he'd had 3 hours sleep Monday morning and stayed up all Monday night into Tuesday morning, either studying or working on a particularly troublesome arpeggio sequence for his guitar ensemble, Beginner, class. He'd spent Tuesday night sealing the barrel of the starboard bow laser before being dragged to bed at 2 a.m. by a worried, upset, and verbose Jacron, waking at 6 to study for an 8 a.m. pre-finals quiz. In the past 69 hours, he'd had a total of 6 hours, 30 minutes sleep, and now Mac was journeying in lands where not even the foul, viscous stuff he brewed for coffee could guide him. Checking the alignment of a couple of wheels one final time, Mac tightened the bolts, sealed up the engine, and carefully walked around the cramped chamber, placing the safety covers back onto the rotary track. Inside the circle sat a largish gun turret, flexible ammo tubes running up from the gun itself to magazines concealed under the cargo deck plating. With the details of fluid state electronics echoing through his ears, Mac crawled out of the maintenance tube surrounding the turret and lowered himself into the turret's control chair, strapping himself in before flipping it upside down.
The transparent aluminum turret windows revealed only the steel gray of the ejectable hull panel that hid the turret from outside view. That panel also hid the sight of Mac hanging down against the harness, switching on the small gravity shield and bringing the railgun's magnetic accelerators online. The primitive but deadly Rebeltech railgun turret was standard issue for the underbelly of every CFMF warship as a defensive shield ripper to deter attacks from below. It would be the most powerful gun on Mac's little ship, if the repairs were successful. The ammo chambers were empty, so that red light was still burning on the gun's status board. Mac keyed the turret to test mode, and the red light winked out, leaving the board entirely yellow. Pulling his advanced calculus book from his jumpsuit, Mac keyed in a basic test sequence and read along with the voice in his headset as the turret smoothly rotated through 720 degrees, then rotated back again, then shook in short back-and-forth sweeps like an old clothes washer agitator. The program made a much more limited test of the vertical axis rotation to avoid hitting the camo plate, then drew a handful of non-ferrous test bolts from the auxiliary ammo feed, and, with satisfyingly loud blats, verified that the accelerators were in perfect working order. Mac didn't look up for a couple of minutes after the test had ended, engrossed in either five-dimensional set factoring or the formulas for electrical resistance in duotronic units. When he did look up, only three yellows remained, all concerning the main ammo feed. Every other system on the gun was green. Mac yanked off his headphones and whooped with delight. The railgun rotor had been the last weapon system repair left to the No Bull, or the Beast, as the duelists had taken to calling it. All that remained was to cast a few thousand iron bolts for the mass driver, secure some Tabana gas from the gray market for the blasters, and the No Bull would no longer have to rely on its speed, which it had, or its maneuverability, which it didn't, to evade attack. It took a little while for Mac's laughter and celebration to die down enough for him to hear the patient knocking of someone against the hull. Blinking away the sudden mental image of Duke Blink, the Phantom Pirate, spaced by his crew centuries ago and still wandering space begging to be let aboard another ship, Mac powered down the turret, righted himself in the chair, unstrapped, and walked down to the passenger airlock. The silhouette hanging just outside the reach of the airlock lights gave Mac 1 second's terrified thought that the ghostly pirate captain had come for him after all. Then Azalin Devir Natashkin stepped into the light, and the broad shoulders of the pirate were revealed as a thick blanket hung rolled up over Azalin's shoulders. "Good morning, Mac," she said with a smile. "Are things going well with you?" "Superb," Mac replied, stepping down from the airlock onto the grass of Port Gerardar's broad airfield. "I've fixed the short in the number 3-4 ion drive's control circuit, installed the sound systems for the passenger berths, tuned up the thing, Mac shuddered reflexively, "and now the weapon systems are just 2 steps away from being completely operational." "That's nice," said Azalin, nodding. "Meanwhile, Jacron sent me looking for you 3 hours ago, with this." She held up the blanket and removed from its folds a spare school uniform. "He's threatened to chain you to your bunk for finals week, and Professor Stuvek asked me to tell you that, although he is intrigued by your insights into the continuation of pre-Reformation literary themes into post-Serac writings, he found them much more coherent on his ride with you to B5 last week than at any point during his classes in the past month." Mac scratched his head, smiling sheepishly. Stuvek's Vulcan literature class was the only one Mac shared with any of the duelists for a term. "I'm usually preoccupied during the week," he said, adding reluctantly, "lately I get more rest flying than anywhere else." "You know," Azalin said slowly, "I never have been inside your ship before." None of the duelists had yet. Although Mac listed his ship on the Student Union travel board and made 1 shuttle run on the B5 Bajor-Gerardo triangle run any Saturday and Sunday he had no charter, the duelists had chosen the slightly more expensive shuttle service for their infrequent visits to B5. A couple of them avoided Mac's ship out of fear, Jacron especially, after his one experience with Mac's love of barnstorming, but most, as Alin thought, were staying away out of plain good taste. "Would you like to show me around?" Mac blushed a little, and his mouth said something his brain normally would never have let loose. "I thought I wasn't your type, Azalin." Azalin giggled and threw the blanket and clothes at Mac. "Just the half-credit tour, please, and nothing else, silly." Mac walked Azalin through the ship, first to the cargo hold and engineering deck, pointing out the railgun turret he'd been working on and the two laser emplacements tucked between the four ion-drive exhausts. Anyone looking for a blind spot in the engine area would receive a nasty surprise. The cargo area itself was not exactly spacious, about the size of a large bedroom, with a large new bulkhead sealing off the upper portions. "That's for the extra heads and shower," Mac said. "I had to expand those when I added the two extra passenger berths." From there it was up to the main deck, which, to Eslin's intense disappointment, did not look different from the cargo deck. The floors were bare steel, the wall panels either industrial gray, warning red, or in a couple of places missing altogether, bearing the wiring conduits beneath. The narrow berths had a broad couch with harness, that, along with an overhead foldaway, could be converted into twin bunks. 3/4 of the bunks' vidscreens were blown out, all of them centuries old, and the upholstery in them had all been replaced with a random patchwork of fabric remnants, poorly applied. The bridge was the worst of the lot. The control panels were obviously cobbled together, even to Azalin's inexperienced eyes. The 4 crash seats for pilot, co-pilot, comm officer, and forward gunner had not been reupholstered, and the ancient leather had cracked and split in so many spots that the chairs looked more white than black. Azalin noted the thick rolls of duct tape slipped over each arm of the pilot's chair. Mac had apparently been using it on something besides the seats. Azalin resolved then and there that, should she ever return to the No Bull, it would be at the head of a crack team of combat guerrilla interior decorators. Mac, meanwhile, was trying to keep himself from babbling, with the result that he was babbling in short, blunt sentences. "Got the weapons control system salvage out of a Celestin patrol ship. Hardly used. They'll go through an inch of duralloy plate at half a click in 2 shots. God, I wish they'd been ready when I got here." It took a moment for Azalin to realize that Mac's tour, or at least his running commentary, had ended with that statement. "Why's that?" she asked, more as a conversational placeholder than anything else. Mac slowly lowered himself into the pilot's chair, invited Azalin to sit beside him, and said, "Broadbank." Didn't spare much thought for her over the summer. I'm ashamed to admit that, when I first heard about her, I felt a bit gratified. Just what she deserves, right? But then I thought, here now, she's trying to mend her ways and make a new start. I've grown up believing that new starts are a right, if you're really committed to changing. It seemed really unfair, then, that someone dedicated to a change should lose their chance at it like that. Azalin nodded to herself, slouching down in the co-pilot's chair. That was part of her own thought process on the subject as well, when she wasn't feeling guilty about rejecting Liza herself. The wound from Liza's disappearance had closed over since, but it was still tender, still subject to twinging when it was prodded. Like now. And when I thought that, I very nearly jumped back into the Noble again. I wanted to just, whoosh, off to the Cardassian border, do my own looking for her. But I couldn't, because without guns, this ship couldn't do anything about it if I did find the attackers, or if the Cardies took exception to my presence. And now it's too late. Trail's gone dead cold. IPO doesn't know where. Skye's people don't know where. Debris fields scattered to hell and gone now, or else scavengers have grabbed it. No ransom, no slave market, no release, no body, no nothing. For all we know, Liza and all those unaccounted for Skrang have been teleported to Tiki's little neighborhood. Azalin couldn't help giggling at that. When Mac glared at her, she smirked and said, "I'll bet she wishes she was in the slave pens, then." Max snorted, not seeing the humor in his own sarcasm. So now all I can do is pretend Elizabeth Broadbent never existed and go on with my life. He stared out the viewport at the dark mist, obviously dissatisfied with the prospect. His left hand twitched a ragged beat as he leaned his chin against his right fist. Damn, damn, damn. Oh, I don't know, Azalin said with a twinkling grin. Then you'd have to forget how you taught her to appreciate Packlet opera. Mac's chin shot up off his fist, his body going rigid as he stared at Azalin. You knew? You can't expect to hide nighttime raids from a nocturnal creature, Azalin chided him gently. Especially a bored nocturnal creature. I'm probably the only one who knows what you got Kate for her birthday, or whose bra and panties were stitched to the WPI flag the first day of C-term finals. Mac couldn't help chuckling at the memory. Liza never did claim those from Dean Montaigne, he said. And I, for one, Azalin said with a grin, can't wait to see what you have planned for dear little Clarissa. Well, Mac said, stifling a yawn, I haven't decided. Broadbitch version 2.0 has not yet discommoded Ms. Hutchins, the duelist, the Art of Noise, myself, or much of anyone else as yet. Wait until she does. You know, Azalin said slowly, I wouldn't mind helping you with that if there's a chance for it. When Mac grunted agreement, she continued, I think I prefer your method. Mysterious, anonymous, cosmic justice. Never anything permanent, just something embarrassing or inconvenient. A strong hint that maybe what she's doing is wrong. Azalin sighed and leaned back in the chair, shifting a bit to avoid a particularly rough edge of split leather. One of the ancients said that the true measure of one's love is in one's power to make the unloving return love. I really wish I'd had that chance with Elizabeth. The chance to make things right with her, to bring her into our little family. I wish I hadn't written her off as unreachable when it's so obvious now that she could have been reached if I'd just tried harder. But, she went on, shrugging, maybe I'll have that chance yet. The spirits work in means beyond our perception, you know. Perhaps next time Liza will rescue us from the forces of evil. I'd like to see that, wouldn't you, Mac? Mac had passed out asleep in the pilot's chair. With a smile, Azalin closed the blinds on the cockpit viewports and wrapped the blanket around Mac's body. Normally they don't fall asleep until after. She giggled to herself, before skipping off to inform Professor Stuvek and Mac's other teachers that Mac wouldn't be showing for his Thursday AM classes. A few moments later, she returned to the cockpit, found the alarm clock stashed by the comm unit, and turned it off before rushing out again. Final examinations at the end of A-term weren't generally too bad at WPI. Maybe it was just because the students' reserves of energy hadn't yet been tapped, but they never seemed to be as drained by the first finals of the year as they were by the ones at the end of, say, C-term. The pattern seemed to be holding at DSM. On Friday night, the student body was feeling conscious and active enough to muster quite a good showing at the Halloween dance, the first school function, aside from the opening ceremonies, to be held in the new grand ballroom. As in previous years at WPI, much of the student body missed the point of Halloween. They showed up for the dance in their finest formal wear and wore silly little domino masks as a concession to the fact that it was billed as a masquerade. And as in previous years, the IBGF/Duelist Society clove instead to the occasion's true spirit and came in costume, much to the disgust of Clarissa Broadbent and her slowly expanding power base. There were a lot more of them this year than last, and so their costumed panoply made a great deal more of an impression, especially since, as the dance was held in the grand ballroom, Professor Krog could once again act as chamberlain and announce the guests as they arrived. In most cases, this was done normally, once again putting the lie to the dance's billing as a masquerade, but the duelists and their friends wouldn't have that, and so they presented special information to Dean Montaigne when they arrived, and it was passed on to Krog, who got into the spirit immediately. Standing at the top of the grand staircase, attired in the scarlet, white, and gold regalia of a Persian prince, burnous, scimitar, pointy shoes and all, the Klingon professor boomed, "The Honorable Moltar, King of the Lava Men!" The figure that emerged from the doors, passed Krog, and began descending the stairs was enormous, and made even larger by the fact that he wore the bulky, heavily insulated encounter suit of a Magmaloran Lava Man, green, brick-red, and brown, with a mirrored visor, and what looked like a little respirator module. This immense figure inclined his helmeted head to the professor as he passed, and then made his way in stately dignity to the dance floor. The buzz spread among those already in attendance immediately. They knew who he was, of course. With those proportions, he had to be Moose McEachern, and that meant that the band geeks and duelists were at it again this year. Many of the regular students looked forward to seeing what the others had come up with. A few, off in the corner, were shaking their heads in sad dismissal. How old was McEachern now? 16? 17? A junior, anyway. Surely old enough to know better. One by one they came, and one by one they were announced by Krog with a completely straight face. There was Caitlin of Avalon, a wood-bedecked Pictish warrior in tartan and linen with a bronze-headed spear. Syongius of the First Legion, an ancient Roman centurion, with green hair. Urthur Snowmane, Norse goddess of love. Please, even the castle's token adult was making a juvenile spectacle of herself, although they did have to admit that her elaborate navy blue tiger-trimmed vestments were quite eye-catching. And, of course, Samurai Wakaba, her golden and crimson lacquered armor clacking and gleaming, the very picture of a feudal Japanese warrior. Azalin, persuaded not to dress as the Dentrovian wolf princess for the third year running, instead had found some fuzzy, stretchy fabric somewhere, acquired a pair of Gag's Seleucian primary ear prostheses, dyed her tail, and come as a yellow house cat, albeit an unsettlingly nubile one. Miki and Dorothy were back in their old Toronto goth gear, going around being mockingly crushed by the weight of their ennui. Peril, fully into the spirit of things, had been rinsed black and dressed in a little tuxedo vest, and was lounging on Dorothy's shoulder looking suitably bored and batting at one of her crucifix earrings. Skye had pulled out all the stops. After being for some time stuck for an idea, owing to his rather odd, by human standards, construction, he'd acquired some metallic makeup and odd bits of armor plating, and had come as Swoop, the Dinobot bombardier. Beldandy Morisato was slightly hampered by the fact that, however she dressed, she looked the same. She'd come dressed as a 20th-century biker gang member, black leather, torn jeans, studs, chains, etc., but she just ended up looking like the Blessed Madonna dressed as a 20th-century biker. A teacher? They dragged a teacher into this silliness? Well, Clarissa Broadbank pointed out cattily, she is Caitlin's half-brother's aunt. Oh yes, that family is just rife with bizarre liaisons. Did you know she has a younger full brother who is almost exactly the same age as that half-brother? Honestly, good lord. Utena Tenjo, with Bell's connivance, came as a Valkyrie. Not a modern Valkyrie, in a black, silver, and scarlet dress uniform, Luger opposite the Thorn of the Rose on her belt, jackboots clicking on the hard-tiled floor, winged skull and thunderbolt glinting on her peaked cap, but a Valkyrie of legend, with her glossy pink hair tied back into a pair of heavy plates, a glittering golden helmet, armor of leather and cold black iron, tightly laced fur boots, a steel round shield emblazoned with the duelist's rose crest, and a fighting spear, its wicked point and edges shielded by a black plastic safety guard. Corwin Ravenhair, her invited guest, who actually was a Valkyrie, had nearly fallen down at the sight of his dear friend in such a getup. He himself was dressed as a Napoleonic-era British naval officer, tricorner hat, dress saber and all, and was announced by the Chamberlain as Admiral Sir Corwin Ravenhair, RN, KCB, much to Caitlin and Utena's delight. Accompanying him was a tiny, black-striped, bright-orange creature who claimed only the name Tigger. "You, my dear dragon, said Caitlin admonishingly as Nall jumped from Corwin's shoulder into her arms, "are a shameless snuggle hound."
"You know it, Honey Pie," Nall replied smugly.
Jacron appeared in the guise of his revered Uncle Jakar, currently the Narn regime's ambassador to Babylon 5. Unfortunately, that primarily consisted of dressing in elaborate leathern clothing whose distinct significance, compared to Jakron's own formal traditional Narn garb, was only apparent to well-schooled Narns. As such, the effect was somewhat lost on the assembled gathering. Beld Marmo, getting cheerfully into the spirit of things, had taken his hair out of its accustomed centauri fan and let it just fall lankly behind his head. Combined with his naturally bushy eyebrows, his prominent chin, the elaborate black plate armor he'd acquired somewhere, and the fur-edged cape he wore over it all, he made a decent likeness of a younger version of galactically renowned crackpot Lord Wolfgang Amadeus von Farvergnügen. Janis Barlow, Hannibal Hamlin II's intrepid resident advisor, demonstrated her unshakable commitment to the social and mental well-being of her charges by putting on a ball gown and getting Mrs. Morisato to do her hair up, all to trump Harcourt Mackenzie's evasive claim, "I'd go as the dread Pirate Roberts, except that I don't have a buttercup." Mac had figured he'd be safe enough with that evasion, but he was game about it, and except for the wrong hair color, he made quite a passable dread pirate.
"Or possibly Zorro," Azalin mused. "I have a hard time keeping track of Earth's masked mythic heroes. There are so many of them."
"I want a picture," said Mac. "Dad will go absolutely spare when he sees this."
Beld furrowed his brow. "You keep using that word," he said. "I do not think it means what you think it means."
Mac declined to explain standard dialectic drift. The next two to arrive were announced by Krolg as Bilan of Minbar and Mi'ia Vestiausa of Chronos, and the perfection of their costumes startled even the catty disparagers into silence. Not only had Mi'ia Ausa somehow managed to change herself, alabaster complexion, crest and all, into an extremely authentic-looking, twilight-skinned, dreadlocked Klingon warrior maid, traditional armor and batleth included, she'd also contrived to change dusky Bilana Torres into a perfectly convincing, hairless, white-skinned, smooth-foreheaded, bone-crested Minbari priestess in white and silver robes. Chenan, who had been sort of stuck for ideas and so had come dressed, most irreverently, as a gray counselor, first burst out laughing, and then, as she got closer and saw how perfect a job it was, stared in awe.
"Wow, you two," she said. "That's incredible work. How'd you ever do it?"
"Oh," said Mi'ia airily, "it's really just an extension of borrowing each other's clothes."
Juri Arisugawa had just smiled whenever anyone asked her what she was going to do for Halloween, and hadn't shown signs of actually preparing. Miki Kaworu, who had known her longest, predicted that she wouldn't be masquerading, that if she came to the dance at all, it would be in her old Otori Academy dress uniform, perhaps with the usual domino mask concession to the holiday. Azalin had insisted that Juri just wasn't that boring. Juri had resolutely refused to comment, only smiled a surprising little I'm-up-to-something smile. On Thursday afternoon, after finals, she had mysteriously taken the shuttle up to Babylon 5 on her own, stayed there for an hour, and returned with a package, on whose contents she refused to comment. Now all eyes turned to the top of the grand staircase, where a tall, slim figure had just entered and paused next to the Chamberlain to be announced. And announce this figure Krolg did with a great booming flourish.
"The terror that flaps in the night!"
The figure standing next to Krolg was certainly dressed the part, all in violet, from the peak of her broad-brimmed slouch hat to the cuffs of her razor-creased trousers. The buttons on her neatly tailored double-breasted jacket were shining silver, and her wingtip shoes were gleaming black, but all the rest was purple. Her cape, lined in a lighter purple that matched her hatband, was furled over her shoulders, and a violet silk scarf masked the lower half of her face. The very picture of Hammer. Except that with that lesser height, that wasp-waisted figure, and those merriment-filled, sparkling green eyes, She was definitely and absolutely not Martin Rose. Caitlin stood at the bottom of the grand staircase and stared up at her in blank-faced and slightly unfocused, Pictish warriors don't wear eyeglasses, astonishment for several seconds. Then she burst out laughing and would have fallen over if Utina and Corwin hadn't caught her under the arms and held her up. She laughed for a solid minute, tears of mirth streaking the woad on her face, giving Jury plenty of time to pull her scarf down below her chin, descend the stairs, and stand there smiling at her. This, of course, made Kate break again every time she calmed down enough to focus on Jury again, until finally she was laughed out, panting for air, and trying to congratulate the redhead on her triumphant costuming job. Up above, in one of the ballroom's skylights, Jury's sharp eyes caught a flicker of motion as she accepted these congratulations, and her smile widened ever so slightly. Marty hadn't wanted to intrude on the moment, but it would hardly have been fair to make him miss it, when he'd been the one to make it possible in the first place. Jury only wished Garrett could have been here as well, to witness the triumph of his emergency alterations. The grand entrances over with, the duelists and their friends danced, snacked, and talked, circulating among their schoolmates, generally enjoying the evening. Jury and Kate spent a few minutes over in one corner, where Jury carefully repaired the damage her entrance had done to the intricate pattern of woad on Kate's face. She got a little of the blue stuff on her fingers, but that was all right. By the end of the evening, careful observers would note that she ended up with a little on her face, too. Corwin, who had been dispatched to the buffet table to procure drinks for himself and his not-date, had to stand there for a few moments in amazement as he was served by two tiny figures, costumed as Gigantor and an AS-7D Atlas-class assault destroid, respectively. Once he'd recovered, and wondered if they'd done the costumes themselves or been helped, he turned around and bumped into a black-haired girl dressed as a firefighter, nearly dousing her with the pair of water glasses he carried. "Oops," he said. "Sorry." "Mom?" The last word came out as a startled shout, which drew the attention of a sizable number of people all around. Scold Ravenhair tipped back her yellow fireman's helmet and grinned at her son. "Aw, you figured it out," she said with mock petulance. "Love the uniform," she went on, running a playful fingertip down along the row of brass buttons that held his waistcoat closed. "Mom, quit it," said Corwin under his breath, reddening a little as he slapped ineffectually at her hand. "What are you doing here?" Skuld looked slightly indignant. "Just taking advantage of the downtime before B-term starts to get accustomed to the place." Caitlin, attracted by the shout, came over and asked, "Does that mean you're teaching here next term?" Skuld nodded. "Visiting professor of applied sciences," she beamed. "I took a sabbatical from NIT. I'll be taking half of Division A into a second division so that everybody can get more lab time." She grinned at Corbin's expression, which was midway between pleased surprised and worried surprised. "Don't worry, Corwin, I'll stay out of your way on the weekends," she said.
"Well, that's great," said Corwin. "Are you staying here or commuting?"
"Oh, I'll commute, like Belle. Poor thing, she'd go crazy without me close by to help out around the temple." Corwin declined to comment on that, instead congratulating her again. She smiled, gave him a whack on the shoulder, and moved off to hobnob with some of the other students. It was fun to do that. Most of them didn't realize she wasn't a new student, since she still looked about senior age. Off on the other side of the room, Utina missed all that, and was starting to wonder what was keeping Corwin with the water when she felt a hand on her shoulder. She stiffened instinctively, no one she knew around here would just grab hold of her like that, and turned, to find herself looking down into the bright green eyes of Vigdis Brightblade. The littlest Valkyrie was done up in her full dress uniform, the authentic one, with sidearm and sword, though she'd forgotten the hat, her wavy flame-orange hair cascading free down her back over her silver-lined black cloak.
The silver brocaded pattern on her black overtunic glinted in the overhead chandelier light as she glared up at Utina with what looked a lot like anger to the surprised duelist.
Hi, said Utina, trying to put a good foot forward. You're Vigdis, right? We met briefly in Asgard. I'm Utina Tenjo, she added, putting out her hand.
With her jaw set, Vigdis slapped the offered hand casually aside.
I know who you are, she replied, her voice flat with hostility. What's the meaning of that get-up? She demanded. Do you really think you could be one of us? Think maybe you could even replace me?
The little redhead folded her arms.
Well, think again.
Utina blinked, shaking her mildly stung hand.
What? This is just a costume. You know, Halloween, dress up as something you're not.
You'd best not let Corwin's mother see you that way, Vigdis replied with a smug look. I don't think she'd be amused that you're mocking our traditions that way.
Utina began to get annoyed. Where do you think I got the helmet? She snapped. Listen, kid, I don't know what your problem is, but...
Vigdis's emerald eyes went cold, and she replied stuffily, I'm sure.
You'll excuse me, she added peremptorily,
with a grown-up gravity that would have been funny if it wasn't so insulting.
I have business to attend to. Business between real Valkyrie, she added rather huffily, and then she turned and stalked away.
Utina stood, a very bewildered look on her face, and watched as, out of earshot, Vigdis met Corwin on his way back, corralled him expertly, and led him protesting off in a different direction, hanging onto his arm.
Sheesh, Utina muttered. What the hell's her problem?
Isn't it obvious? Sionji mused quietly, nearly startling the life out of Utina as he seemed to suddenly appear next to her. Ignoring her protest that he not do that, he went on thoughtfully, That girl hates you, Tenjo.
Utina put her hands on her hips and scowled at him. Well, thank you, Professor Positive. You're a real ray of sunshine. What possible reason would she have to hate me? We've only met once.
She hates you, said Sionji, his thoughtful eyes still on Vigdis as she smiled and chattered inaudibly at an increasingly irritated-looking Corwin, for the same reason I did.
Utrina gave him a funny look.
What?
Think about it, said Sionji, and then he turned and moved off into the crowd in search of Wakaba.